Hello and welcome back to the OEM podcast. This is Outwear Mobile's podcast all about the mobile industry. My name is Keith Smyth and I'm the Android team lead here at Outwear. And I'm joined by some very special minds today. We've got two first timers and one old timer. So I'll let everyone introduce themselves so I don't have to get names correct. Pete, why don't you give us a start?
Apparently I'm the old timer. I'm not quite sure how to take that. But my name is Pete Collins. I work in the design team here at Outwear.
Hi guys, my name is Will. I'm a visual designer here at Outwear. Been here for the last 3 months. First time.
Newbie.
Yeah, welcome. Don't worry, you won't be worse than me. It's all good. And to my other side.
Hello, I'm Benedict. I'm the iOS team lead here. And I know nothing about design. Well, not that I know nothing. I know that I know nothing.
That's okay.
My years of failing to design.
That's okay.
In the visual sense, of course, not in the code sense.
Developers can't design, and that's why you're on the developer side of the table with me.
Ready for
war. Very divided today.
It's going to be a war. So today, we're going to discuss development and design, and there's a big conversation going on around how the two jobs are kind of becoming, should they become one? Should they become eight? Who knows? I think we need more developers, but I digress. So I guess, how do we get this started?
I think the point you just made is interesting, where you said, are the roles becoming one? Or I think historically they used to be. If you said, I'm a web developer, I'm a web designer, that would mean that you pretty much do everything.
Yeah.
Now, you're a visual designer, a web a coder, you're a wireframer, you're an interaction designer. There's just so many specialized disciplines now of every single part of the process.
Yeah, I guess there's different levels of developer as well. So there's sort of front-end developer, back-end developer.
Yeah, if you go back to 2010, a lot of the jobs advertised were front-end developer plus designer. Now that's kind of changed quite a bit. There's more jobs for a designer rather than just looking at the HTML and the CSS and a bit of JavaScript, especially in the mobile sphere.
So there's a distinction between mobile designer and designer, I don't know, web.
It's funny because on the one hand, I think there's definitely a trend where there's definitely been a specialization of roles. But also, if you look at the trends in how easy it is now for a designer to learn to code, or how easy it is for a developer to design, they are also at the same time, it sounds weird, but whilst they're also specializing, they're also diverging in some senses. Because if you look at tools that we might use from a design perspective, some of the interaction design tools which will auto-generate code for us now. So things like Quartz Composer or Framer.js or Pix8's about to start doing that as well.
Yeah, we're being replaced. We're done, Ben.
Where's the focus? When you're a designer and you're working with a tool that's generating code, you're still ultimately going to be relying on the developer to implement it. And even given our own experience, we see that, generally speaking, those tools don't produce first-class code that we want to put in client projects, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And the same with from the flip side of the coin. So, you know, there's a lot of tools to help developers implement standardized designs, you know. But again, you don't end up with first class results, right? I think the specialization that we've seen over the last few years is the maturation. Is that the right pronunciation? Of our industry, you know?
You said it with an English accent. It sounds right.
Yeah. So, you know, in the past, absolutely, you know, when the web was young and everyone was a web designer or a webmaster, remember that word, right? What does that encapsulate? That's everything, doesn't it? And that was an opportunity to do everything really badly, I think.
Internet's master, the AOLs.
But yeah, to your point, I think it's, I think probably the movements we've seen in kind of Learn to Code and Code Academy, which has got, I was looking this morning, it's got kind of 24 million people now learning to code on Code Academy, which is pretty cool. And I think then the rise of loads of kind of standard templates and sketch files and PSDs and all sorts of stuff, which you can just really easily download and, you know, just readily get your hands on. Anybody can do that now. I don't think it's kind of, to your point, I don't think the purpose of all of that is to replace one another in the whole part of the overall process. I read an interesting article on Smashing Magazine earlier this week, which just talks about the role that those tools play in just helping us collaborate and communicate more effectively. So it's giving me as a designer maybe an understanding of your position as a developer, so I can understand the constraints or you know, why something might be hard to implement. So it's not necessarily that I need to be able to code, but I can then understand from a design perspective why there's an easy way to approach a problem, or and vice versa. You might understand why we've designed something in a particular
way. I think that's the key. It's more about understanding each other's process. So designers understanding the developer process, developers understanding how designers work. Because if you have designers trying to learn all the code, you're just duplicating that knowledge. And the designers can be learning a multitude of other things instead of replicating what all the developers are doing.
Mm. Something I'm kind of keen to get your guys' opinion on. That's the developers of the opposite side of the table, by the way. People can't see me point on a podcast. I've just realized that.
The pointcast.
The pointcast. But let's say, for example, I mean, I'm a designer and I want to learn to do or to learn to code, or I want to at least be able to start or understand a little bit more. It just seems there is so many different languages now. There is so much, you know, when we talk about specialization, I mean, even in mobile, which seems like quite a specific part of the industry, you can be an iOS dev, an Android dev, you can be a middleware dev, you can be a full stack, like you know, there's so many variations even within that discipline. Where on earth do you start? Like, is Code Academy a good place to start? Or, you know, there are kind of good entry-level dev courses at General Assembly? Or, I mean, like, I don't know, where's the place to start as a designer that wants to learn to code?
With university, no. I mean, with anything, like if you're just coding just randomly, you tend to sort of just kind of lose interest. So if you've got these small little feedback loops where you make something and it works, like you make a Hello World website and it works and you're like, oh, this is great, and then you start enjoying it, and that's where the really good learning will come in. So if you start with a goal of what you want to do, I want to do a website, or I want to make an Android application, or God forbid, an iOS application. I'm smiling at Ben. if you start with your goal and then you look into how to achieve that goal, or you ask someone how to achieve that goal, and then you've got a starting point. But online sites like Codecademy and things like that, they're really good to give some of the guidance around it. But a lot of the thing from development, which I'm sure is the same with design, comes from practice. So yeah, you can learn, you can tell someone how to ride a bike like a million times and they're just going to fall off every time until they sort of practice riding the bike. And some people, like our producer, right, falls off his bike even though he's had lots and lots of practice.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, look, I completely agree with you, Keith. I think everybody's got a different learning style and you've got to move towards what interests you and inspires you, you know. I guess we could flip the question back on you, Pete, and if I as a developer want to learn to design, it seems like there's, you know, so many different tools out there. There's the fundamentals of, you know, good design. There's, you know, even just looking at paths in Illustrator can be confounding. And, you know, whenever I have to extract assets from Photoshop, you know, can feel a bit of a technical novice at times as well. So
I guess the key is just stick to one. There is a lot of tools out there, but if you stick to one and learn it well, just I guess it's the same with developing. If you stick to one language, it's going to be a lot more beneficial for you than flipping between three or four.
The thing about that is, I mean, the one is always changing. So, you know, you may say, of course, you know, you want to learn to code. Of course, you want to learn iOS development, right? And I might look across and the cool kids seem to be using Sketch these days, right? And that is in support of, you know, developing templates for mobile apps, right? And designs for mobile apps. Is that an appropriate place to learn to start learning, or isn't there some more fundamental skills that we need to learn or understanding of the world? Like, how do you view the world? This is a whole philosophical.
I think the basic principles of design are really important even before you get into the program. So if you look at basic principles like color, alignment, balance, use of space, all these principles are essential to your design. So if you go back and look at the history of design before you even get into the program, I see a lot of developers getting stuck there. Like, we had a design hack night a couple of weeks ago where everyone was learning the software, but it was the basic principles that they needed to go back and have a look at. So I think that's where you need to start.
Right. So that's a much bigger journey than just learning some piece of software and the, you know.
It is. But there's a bunch of really great books out there that you can read about that. And yeah, if you can find a designer, sit with them and they'll be able to teach you the basics.
So how much of design is natural talent And how much is study and practice?
I think it's safe to say it's a good 99%. That's natural talent here.
No, I mean, no, it's all talent. All learnt. Everything is learnt, just like you guys. Design is a learnt skill.
It's always been magic to me. Just the designer looks at it and goes, oh yeah, that key line is actually 2 pixels. It should be 1. How could you see that?
Looks too like much a big time staring blur. At the screen.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of it is skills that you've learnt. But then, you know, I think, I mean, just as coding will come a lot more naturally to some people, design comes a lot more naturally to other people. That's not to say you can't, if it doesn't come naturally, you can't learn to become to get a reasonable level of skill in design. But I think obviously the people that have a natural affinity for colors and layout and that sort of stuff are going to be generally have a lead in that space.
Someone who's colorblind,
yeah,
not so good.
Yeah,
that was an interesting one. I used to teach design for a while, and I had a student who was colorblind.
Oh, really?
Interesting. Yeah,
and we had to use all the hex values to try and tie up the values with colors in the real world. And emotions. So when he was designing something, he had to relate to the color value rather than actually how it looked.
Oh, wow. That's a hard way to learn. Yeah.
He didn't last long. I think he got into black and white illustrations after that. Cool.
So it'd be a good job for accessibility there. If you had someone with design skills but was colorblind, they could actually have a look at your designs from a good design mind, but colorblind.
Keith, you're a genius. That is something I'd never even considered. Visual accessibility. There you go.
We've done a lot of accessibility apps lately. Yeah. So.
But I think just to back to Benedict's point about, I guess, how would you learn design or something, it's interesting that if you go and look at the HIG or the Android guidelines from 3 years ago, you'd be hard pushed to find a lot of content in there that talks specifically about, you know, grids and use of white space and spacing of elements and font weights and all that sort of stuff. Now you really can't get away from that sort of stuff in the HIG and the design guidelines. It's really buried in there, and I think that's beginning to give kind of blur the lines of the dev and design world in mobile. I think that's giving kind of developers a really good sense of you know, you almost know before you get a sketch file from us kind of what the expectation is in terms of, you know, what typeface we've used.
Isn't that a bit disappointing? Isn't it all becoming rather homogenous? And they're just trying to save us from ourselves, from making hideous.
Have you seen a lot of most of the apps that are out there?
well, you know, sure, we can, you know, criticize aesthetic tastes, right? But the variety is the richness of life. And we don't go to an art gallery and see, you know, template pieces of artwork compiled from, you know, pre-canned, like, types of style. You know, it's... Well, that's right. And ultimately, you know, the designs that have really struck us aren't the ones that are, you know, perfectly in line with
the guidelines,
expectations.
Yeah.
They're the ones that really blow us away and reveal a new sort of opportunity.
I think this is an interesting topic. Like the move towards flat design it's an interesting one because we had skeuomorphism for a long time. And that was, I think it was a way to get people to see things in the real world and how they'd look in the mobile.
Assist with the transition.
But now people are kind of used to that, and so the move to flat probably works pretty well.
Are you sure that's just not a rationalization to sort of manage the transition and make it all more comfortable for us? Because, I was a fan of skeuomorphism.
Were you?
Really? Yeah, absolutely. And iOS 7, 8, you know, where are those buttons? It drives me crazy. It's not right, right? And I think in the Apple Watch, Apple have admitted that it's not right. They've made those buttons more tangible, right? And I think maybe they overreached, right? They delivered too quickly on that transition. And they've had to reel it back a little bit. And I don't know, are we going to find a middle ground where we...
Yeah, I don't agree. I think if you think in form and function, you want your app to be functional first. And there was a lot in skeuomorphism which got in the way of the design and how people used their apps and their tools. So I think it strips back everything that's unnecessary. I think it's more much more honest approach to design than what was... there originally. So yeah, I don't think this is going to be a fad. I think this is something that's going to last. I think it's probably pretty innovative. It's at its infancy at the moment, and it's going to grow and it's going to change, but it'll probably take a few years.
I just look forward to it growing. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. We're in some
space
at the moment that is incomplete.
Yeah, I think, I mean,
yeah, this, I agree with that.
You know, we've got Dub Dub and IO coming up in a couple of weeks, and I'm sure we're going to see some really kind of good, solid updates to both design styles and languages and everything.
Material's been getting updates.
It has. It's been getting a lot of updates. But, you know, in all fairness to Google, there are several different styles of buttons that we can use. And so, you know, that's, I guess, where it comes down to the design rule is picking the right button style for the UI is to make sure that, you know, we're not undermining the experience by choosing a button that's hard to see or hard to find in relation to the rest of the screen. So
breaks expectations.
Exactly, yeah.
When I first used Snapchat, I felt like an old man because it's very, you've got to swipe to get to the next area up or down or left. And like, what's going on with this thing? Where's my floating action button?
But I mean, it's like, it's a good point that you make though about, you know, now that they are making it so easily through the kind of guidelines and through templates and files that you can download to come up with an interface. Like, you know, a lot of people can wear the hat of a kind of basic UI designer now. But you could go and download, you know, there's hundreds of sketch resources out there and you can just literally change the values in a text label or a text field. And depending on what your app needs or wants to do, whether it's, you know, grid layouts, list views, whatever, like it's,
did you send me a link?
I will send you a link, Keith, yes.
That'd be great.
But it's, you know,
I can do UI design. Yeah.
But I've read, you know, quite a few articles where they do say that, you know, our interfaces and UIs just all beginning to look the same. And I think there is magic still in trying to design something that maybe, you know, finding a project or a client or an app or something where you can be a bit more experimental and break the mold and not worry about necessarily conforming completely to those guidelines, I think is always an exciting idea. Because at the end of the day, they are guidelines. That's a kind of key word in the title layers.
I think there's a few different things at play here. And one of those is risk. People don't want to have to take that risk to produce something unexpected, unintuitive or bad. So they just play it safe. My background is I've done a lot of web development. And so I've seen a lot of bad websites. And the emergence of Bootstrap, you're familiar with the Bootstrap CSS framework, was like, for me, it was a magical thing. It meant that, you know, I could bang out a website and users would be comfortable and it looked decent and it was familiar. But the prolification of it became, you know, almost infectious. Every startup was using Bootstrap as the template. And, you know, it's the flip side of that kind of standardization that we see, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
Websites are doing that still these days. You've still got those scrolling websites that scroll on. There's a parallax scrolling. Mm. Yeah. And you've got the big full screen, slightly grayed out motion picture. I sound like an old man again.
That was an innovative effect that was very rapidly adopted really broadly, right? Suddenly it was everywhere. And then you know, 3 months after you first saw it, you were burnt out from it.
They still haven't gotten it to be performant. Yeah, it still just chugs.
I mean, this isn't something that we haven't seen before. I mean, if you look at design from back in the 50s and 60s, this like simple abstraction of simple shapes is something that's been used before. And some of the designs that were done back then were pretty amazing. It's probably, for me, it was probably the height of design. So, and the simple elements that are being used now are kind of the same as it was back then. It's just how we use those and how we can abstract the elements we've got out to make them more interesting and engaging for users.
There you go. Back to the 50s. Yeah. At the same time as with, you know, the Apple Watch has just launched and all this cool tech design, we're heading back to the 50s.
We're going backwards.
Yeah. It was a good time.
Right before. The automotive industry is similar.
Yeah.
You look at like more recent cars, they're nowhere near as good looking as the old cars.
Exactly.
So they're trying to harken back.
Except Tesla. I'm just going to put in a shameless plug for Tesla there because I do love Tesla.
If we plug Tesla enough, they'll send us a car,
yeah,
right?
I hope so.
Sure. Hope so. We have enough viewers. I mean, to go back to a previous point on the sort of design and development, like it's easier now for a developer to do some basic design with all the HIG and the material guidelines things coming out and really spelling it out. Like this should be, you know, 8-dip from the left most of the time and this should be set out this way and these are even the fonts and font sizes and everything that you should use. It's much that gap is shortened between like a designer and a developer. But I think the value of a designer at that point then is a designer can take it to the next level up.
Like, we hope so, yeah. I mean, being sat on this side of the table, we hope we can. But yeah, I mean, it just, I really feel that it does kind of come back to that point that, I mean, exactly as you put it there, just closes the gap between the two roles. I think that's the whole purpose of a lot of these tools and, you know, the emergence of all that kind of design information in the HIG and all that sort of stuff is just it's allowing us to find some common ground.
It allows us to communicate with other developers. And if you've got a big team and each of you knows what the other does.
Makes more sense. Instead of trying to just do something and throw it over the fence to the other side, to quote Mr. Peach Talbot, it's more you can sit down and work with the developer and the designer.
Exactly, yeah.
That's you're all being so damn agreeable. And I
disagree. You disagree.
I absolutely do. Here we are. What are we talking about? We're talking about the HIG, these material designs that are telling us how we need to lay everything out. We don't need you designers anymore. Wait a couple more years and those guidelines will become more and more refined and people's expectations will become more and more standardized.
Yeah. Well, it's...
Then you're going to need to learn how to do development, right? Because otherwise you've got nothing to do, my friend.
Well, maybe it's a race. Maybe the race is on because, we mentioned it before, but there are the kind of interesting space for me at the moment, or the really interesting space. And it's been happening for a while. It's definitely nothing new. But is, a lot of the interaction design tools that we're seeing kind of very widely adopted in mobile now. I mentioned Framer.js before, but there's Quartz Composer, Pixate. There's the whole spectrum of interaction design tools out there. And I think that's a kind of really interesting space because it genuinely bridges the gap between design and development. You're actually bringing your interface to life and you're seeing how it's going to animate, behave, and how you can interact with it before you've built it. Very valuable thing to do. But like I say, I know at the moment the code it generates is not always useful. There's a very different thing between just generating a source file off the back of an interaction versus coming up with production quality code for, a big client. It's kind of a pretty different ball game. But maybe the race is on then. So you're saying that from a development perspective, design resources are getting there and, you're going to be able to really get a grasp on design, but maybe on our side of the fence, I'm just looking at Will for some moral support for this one.
I agree, if
we can get to a point where the tools that we're using are generating enough code or good code, well, maybe there'll be a war. We'll see.
We had a hackathon recently. Yeah. You guys had a team that was all designers.
All designers. Yeah. We did.
You guys stole all the designers of the entire company.
We did.
Thanks for that.
We did.
Because our team didn't have a designer.
Oh, well, there you go. Sorry about that.
We had UX, but we didn't have design.
Well, but there you go. I mean, there's an interesting...
Because you don't need a designer. Well,
and we didn't need
we still won our category. So
but, so anyway, it's interesting. I think it'll be very interesting to see how it all evolves over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and the landscape is shifting so quickly. Another article I read recently was talking about the array of design tools available and what you can and can't use them for, and I think there's some fairly, obviously Adobe Creative Cloud's been long established and Sketch is beginning to get a bit more of a foothold now, even though it's newer. But then there was a section all about interaction design and prototyping tools, and there is no kind of real industry standard at the moment. It's such an open playing field, and I think that's an area that's really going to kind of mature over the next couple of years, and we will see the emergence of a couple of tools that I think are really going to become a kind of integral part of how design and developers work together. Because I just think, long gone are the days where an app or a website is static, and so it doesn't make any sense for us to just not be working as closely as possible, as early as possible, to bring static content and static design to life.
Look, I think there is always been a long history of trying to adapt the tools to a more general audience. So in like web design, there was Dreamweaver, and then what do we have now, like Squarespace or whatever. So the tools are being delivered to make more specialized skills more accessible, right? But I can't, I guess as time goes on, that forces the people who have those specialized skills, to become more effective in their own domain, and that forces us all towards greater specialization.
I think that's a good thing.
Yeah,
I don't think any tool should be feared.
Fear Photoshop.
Fear those tools.
I used to fear Adobe Flash.
I fear Flash a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. I'm petrified.
But they've all got their purpose.
USB sticks as well.
Sock puppets.
Yeah. We're getting off track here. This could really get out of hand.
So you were saying?
I was just saying that I think, all tools have got their purpose. Like I think we were talking about Squarespace logo the other day. A tool where you can make a logo in 2 minutes. Yeah, Keith, you made one.
I made a logo for Outwear.
And
for the podcast. And,
I mean, you're still going to need people who are with expertise in branding to come up with a logo for their company. I mean, you could use logo Squarespace logo, but I think it's for a different purpose. It's for Keith, so he can come up with a logo for our podcast. And I think the same thing with the tools that are used in design and also in development. It's just about different purposes, I guess.
Yeah, picking the right tool for the job. Yeah, I agree.
So until this race is won, is there a consensus on what should happen first, design or development?
Wow, that's a big one. I'm just going to answer the question with a question here, just to be annoying for you guys. Let's say you didn't have wireframe stories, you know, a sketch file, PSD, anything. Could you start? What would you do? Where would you start? Is that the answer to your question?
If there were stories,
yeah,
we might be able to start.
Okay. That's user stories for the listeners out there.
User
by the
stories.
Way, just checking everyone's.
So, yeah, basically functionality.
Okay.
So as a actor, I want to do a thing so that I can some sort of benefit.
Okay.
There we go. Now we've explained stories.
So, so you kind of feel like stories is the kind of key part to the process that can then enable both teams to kind of work collaboratively and alongside each other.
What would you do visually?
Well, because I mean, you know, if you look 5-10 years ago, you know, waterfall was a kind of, you know, very widely adopted methodology. You do your design, then you build your designs. But now, obviously, you know, it gets bandied around a lot. But the word, you know, agile as a delivery methodology means that we all kind of work a lot more collaboratively throughout the whole course of the project.
We hug a lot. I think that's
really
what agile's about.
And we hug a lot. That's a kind of key core principle of agile is that we all hug.
Morning hug, the morning stand up.
But, you know, I think, you know, that idea of designing and developing, designing then developing is, in my mind, is kind of long gone. The two are, just like we've, you know, we've tried to blur the distinction internally a little bit, and we're still very much on that journey between the UX, UI and interaction design. It's kind of, and whilst we still have people that are kind of specialized and fill those roles, long gone again are the days where somebody will work in isolation on a set of wireframes and just pass it to a visual designer who will then pass it to a developer. You know, it's just, that's not the right kind of way to work anymore. You just open yourself up to a whole load of technical risks, and you know, you're not actually fulfilling the brief or delivering the, you know, the product that you want. I think ultimately you start both at the same time. I would say you design, you develop, you design, you develop, you design, and along the whole course of the product.
I think there always needs to be a with design at the front. I mean,
well, but aren't you doing kind of iteration zero when you're doing CI setup and all that sort of stuff? And okay, that's not dev, but ultimately you're starting your element of the process.
I just wonder if, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, that our industry is maturing, and in a way that isn't what this process we're describing actually part of the immaturity of industry. If we were to transplant this model to, I mean, a really common metaphor for software development is, if it was property development, would it be acceptable to you know, do things in the agile way in building a property? I mean, that's just madness, isn't it, right? We expect the architectural plans to be completed before we're going to start laying the bricks in place, right?
That is true. But I guess my counter-argument would be is that it's a lot easier for us to move a button in the UI than it is to move the roof of the house. So I guess there's kind of, is agile and its application to software development, is that born out of the fact that it is easier to make change than when building a physical product? Or is that the reason why it's come about, or why it's an acceptable practice in software design?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but as I say, I my speculation is really that we are defining our own standards for development, our own philosophy of how we approach problems and meeting the client's needs. And again, you know, like on the design front, it's going to be interesting to see where we are in 10 years' time if we're still following agile as the
practice,
right?
Standards, yeah, exactly. Or the goal. Yeah.
I think a lot of companies say they're agile, but not a lot of companies are agile. They just mean that, oh yeah, we work in 2-week sprints and we do a stand-up meeting.
Yeah.
But it's still very much locked down on scope, locked down on time, locked down on price, and then timelines and budgets and done. Okay, now be agile.
Yeah, and it's a tricky problem, definitely. Mm. So
there's a lot to take away with it, though. The working together aspect. Like I often say, the poor designers no longer sit together at one side of the building anymore.
Separated.
Yeah, they've all been split out.
Yeah, I mean, changing the geography so that you've got developers sitting next to designers, I think, has helped immensely for the couple of the guys because they've just got them right next to them. If you've got any questions, you can just turn around and say, hey, what do you think of this? Or the developers with us designers, you know, can we change this?
Yeah, and I think you'd be surprised of the effects of that because it's not just a case of being able to collaborate a lot more easily and a lot, but the output of that is ultimately that the quality of your product and the quality of your build is, you know, you realize a lot of benefits, and it's normally in a very kind of very tiny way. So the point you mentioned before about a 2 pixel versus a 1 pixel key line or a drop shadow that might be slightly other, that stuff will just get picked up as you design, as you build, as you develop.
I think it's cultivated some of the relationships as well.
I agree. Yeah.
It's that proximity that's made them a lot closer.
Yeah,
there's a bit more mutual respect between the roles.
From the developer's point of view, designers like are magic gods with much better monitors than we have. And I suppose we are noisy, smelly people with like keyboards that go clacky clack. I wondered if the designers had noticed all the clacking over in the development side. Everyone's brought in their own mechanical keyboards, and
we've seen a couple of those.
Yeah, we do have a rule. We try and keep to the brown switches, which are fairly quiet compared to others. But there's a few keyboards that have snuck in now that you can hear above the others.
we all wear earbuds in the design team, and we're all learning sign language just so we don't have to listen to you. There's a topic I wanted to just quickly bring up, if that's okay, Keith. I don't want to rain on your running order.
Please. I have no running order.
One of the things that when kind of material design was announced and launched, and to a certain extent, I still feel like it's a bit of a grey area for us. And it'd be interesting to see kind of the outcome of I.O. this year. And, you know, same for WWDC, is that there was just an assumption when Google started referring to animations and interactions in the material design guidelines that you would just get that for free in the SDK, or there would be a very easy way to implement those. And as a team, as a designer, we could just say, okay, when you tap on this row in a list view, you know, choose animation B and plug, you know, pull it out of the SDK and it'll work. Now that's, you know, we've obviously learned that that's not quite the case, and it's definitely not that easy.
Well, if you're using Lollipop, you get lots for free, or very cheaply.
Yeah, but I guess. You know, knowing from a design perspective, knowing what you do and don't get for free out of an SDK, and what is easy and what isn't easy to develop, is still a kind of a constant learning area for us. And I don't know the easiest way to approach that problem. And again, I think that's probably just pairing very closely with developers and just making sure you're talking constantly about kind of how you intend to solve the problem, and you'll learn every period of time. But to me, that just seemed like it was a bit of an omission, or just, and I don't know whether that's just, you know, they needed to get material design out there and get people to adopt it. And that, you know, now we will see maybe that they'll start to just kind of make that stuff available. But it was just a big kind of gray area. And when you think from a design perspective about how you're going to solve a problem, or how you might transition from one state to another state, or from one screen to another screen, you know, you can quite easily look through all of the guidelines and just think, oh, you know, that's how it should behave, or that'll be easy for dev to do, or just great, it'll work in this way. And it's, you know, it's hard for us, or sometimes when we think, oh, that's 5 points worth of effort or 8 points worth of effort, or it's a big piece of dev time for you or dev effort, because it's just not as easy as just getting it out of the box. And I think that's just a big hole at the moment, probably more so on our side, is just that kind of really, really being able to get a good grasp about what we can easily do.
And is that Android specific, or is that actually flow into iOS as well?
No, I think it's probably.
I think things are getting better. If you've looked at the Apple Watch human interface guidelines, that document does a pretty good job of illustrating the kind of interactions it supports and the limitations of it, and, you know, the full range of UI elements, right? And it's really nice. I've, you know, recommended clients, non-technical clients, go and have a look at this so you can understand, you know, what we're dealing with, because otherwise, particularly when we're trying to develop for a product that we don't actually physically have, you know, which has been going on for some time, is, you know, to flesh that out and to have a document that supports it in a very visual way is a big improvement. But I agree. Yeah. I mean, I was pushing earlier to say we want to, you know, be able to think outside the box in design terms, but, you know, we have commercial realities that we live by, and the designers do absolutely need to be informed to what comes out of the box for free and what's going to take weeks and weeks.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting with I guess I've just on the spur of the moment thought of an analogy is if you think, I guess, about before you would start from a development perspective, start a feature or an epic, whatever it is, you would need to have a very specific set of API documentation that talks about, service calls, responses, caching time, whatever. There's lots of stuff that it's very specific. You need to understand exactly how that service call or these multiple service calls would work. For us, at the start of the process, the reference point we have is the guidelines or the one of the reference points we have. And so I guess just I can understand the argument that we don't want it to be specific to the point where every interface looks the same, but also having, I guess, a standard to work to is helpful, very helpful.
Yeah, I think there needs to be some kind of bridge because, I mean, the material guidelines are really good, but it's...
A bunch of it's not supported by Google.
Yeah. Which is really surprising to me, really, really surprising.
Yeah, they actually came out in a podcast. Chet Haas, I think it was Chet Haas, mentioned in one of the Android podcasts that they said they didn't give us a floating action button implementation because it's just so easy. And the problem that's occurred now is I've just done a search on GitHub for floating action button and there's 88 different repositories all trying to give you a floating action button in one way or another. So yeah, it's just that easy. Now everyone's done it. And the third highest one, the one with like the third most stars on it, is actually depreciated. So I don't know what's going on there.
So I mean, there's another kind of problem. Maybe Androids and Google are generating for themselves is because there's long been this known issue of device fragmentation and screen sizes and adoption of the OS and this hugely kind of fragmented operating system. But even within the operating system now, there are kind of libraries and functionalities and stuff that are beginning to minutely diverge, and there's no way that every single one of those 88 libraries that you found are going to operate in exactly the same way. So, it's very surprising to me that Google, when they made a very obvious jump and very obvious shift in the way that you build apps with material design, that they didn't back that up with. Because if you think back to when we made the move from iOS 6 to iOS 7, I'm guessing that Apple were pretty stringent about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's interesting to consider, we're talking about technology companies here, yeah? Apple and Google and even the producers of the software that we use, like Adobe. And how does their sort of intent towards design manifest itself in the products they provide? So I think Apple have always been the leaders in design terms of, focusing on a really great user experience, and that has flowed through in a technical level to architecturally. A lot of the frameworks are really nice to work with. A lot of the templates they provide are really good. And so the products are themselves. Now, when you think of Google, if this would have sat true for Apple you could have said that about Apple 10 years ago. But if you rewind to Google 10 years ago, they're very much a technology-focused company and not a design company. Yeah? And so they've had to make a very deliberate step towards, raising the importance of design within what they're trying to deliver, right? Because I think the consumer's expectations are much higher now, and that counts as consumers. We developers are consumers as well as the end user. So, there's like an evolution going on, and there's it's the furthering of civilization, if you like, right? You know what I'm saying? We're building on top of where we've come from, and we're refining and improving, and we're identifying where those gaps exist. Like, Pete, you raise a good point, and for me, that's quite empowering to hear what you're saying. I'm like, okay, I take your point. I'm gonna make a point of making available to you, make it really clear what you do get for free in the iOS platform. Right, because it's not that hard, but from a design standpoint, it's not clear. I agree.
And we're going to do a better one on Android. Just
so, do you think the reason for the guidelines is because, and why they've been so stringent, is that every app that's put on the Play Store or in the App Store is in a way a representation of Apple and Google?
Yeah. Yeah, they represent the platform. Yeah. So it's sort of when you get your phone, it's not just the things that's on the phone. It's all of the apps you download from the Play Store. Yeah.
That's a part of the brand.
And so,
yeah.
And so if you rewind 10 years to Microsoft dominance and everyone's using Windows XP or 95, you know, woo-hoo, there was the consideration of design was never at the forefront of people's minds, right?
It was more about how much information can you put on this screen
exactly
at once.
Yeah, exactly.
Density. And then making it all tabbable. So we've got like 5 minutes left, basically.
Well, time flies when you're having fun.
I know, right? Let's do it again. Yeah. So we will do this again, actually. So in 10 years' time, let's do a follow-up. Yeah?
Okay,
yeah.
We will.
Done.
We will.
All right. We're on. It's all recorded now. So we've been talking about apps that get it wrong and that they are the ones that need this design. Do we have any ideas of what apps we can go around the table that we think get it right in design? Omitting, of course, our own apps because they're all beautiful.
look, on the iOS platform, for me, the CommBank app is really nice if you're in Australia. In the Commonwealth
Interesting
Bank.
To say that.
You know?
Because Android is very similar. Really? CommBank is pretty good.
Yeah. It's satisfying to have a well-designed bank app. I mean, that's that kind of, you know, you almost don't expect it, right? It's a bank.
they should still be doing Windows design.
Exactly.
Right? I'm pretty sure the banks still have Windows machines somewhere in there. Yeah.
There's actually, banking apps are, you know, really beginning to kind of catch up with a lot of very, very cool design and development trends at the moment. You know, if you look at the ANZ app and Westpac, they're doing some kind of cool stuff as well. I think there's some really interesting stuff happening in mobile and the banking space, actually. So,
yeah. Just to go on the flip side of that, I think it's interesting, some of the apps that are really badly designed, even like looking at my Apple Watch app logo, if you saw that appeared on the iOS screen for everybody a couple of versions ago, like, why are you doing this to us, Apple? You know, it's like,
even Apple
themselves
don't get it
right. Somebody
in there
saying, come on, guys, let's do this right instead of just rolling this out for everybody. Yeah.
So for those that haven't seen it, it's the Apple Watch with a black background from the side view. So it's a white watch on it, like from the side, and like the band is done up. So it just looks like a white circle, a bad white circle on a black background.
I think this is the succession to Scott Forstall. I think this is Johnny Ives' downfall. This is the beginning of it. You heard it here first. In 3 years' time, he's out. He's gone.
He's actually working for Samsung.
Yeah, exactly.
You heard that ad? The guy that sounds just like Johnny Ives? Good God, look, they're cheeky.
Just quickly on your question before, I think a couple of apps that I really like that are widely known. I think Storehouse is a beautiful app. We did a kind of design session the other day where we talked about some really nice apps that we like, and one of those that came out was SkyGuide. I think that's really nice. And then another app that I actually think is really, really beautiful is the Expedia iPad app. For those of you that haven't downloaded it, that sounds like a weird suggestion to, you know, plug a travel agent's app. But it is really beautiful. The way they've designed the interactions, the behaviors, the animations, it's just really subtle and beautiful and nicely designed. I would thoroughly recommend checking it out.
My vote would be for Google Keep on Android. I've spoken about that before in a design review, but it just works perfectly. Great transitions, really easy to see the information that you want to see, easy to get rid of any checklists and tick things off. Just works great.
Yep, I agree. Really cool app. Really cool app.
I think I use Pocket Cast by Shifty Jelly.
Okay.
Yeah. It's design-wise, it's really quite good.
Is that from Melbourne?
They're in Adelaide. Yeah.
Not everything great happens in Melbourne, unfortunately.
I'm sure they probably started here or something like that, right?
Yeah, definitely.
We'll claim them. Yeah. It's a nice kind of, it's not perfect material. It's kind of their take on material, which is really nice to see.
Yep.
Like going off those guidelines a bit and taking it, that's that next step.
Yeah.
Is really good.
Yeah,
like, guidelines are good for people like me, but exactly. Cool. All right. So we've done good apps. Okay, so I've got a bit of business to attend to at the back end of the podcast here. So I'd like to mention that Outwear, if you want to work with these lovely people that have all been talking here today and get a chance of being on the podcast, we've had two first timers today as well, and they've enjoyed it. Outwear is hiring. So
come join us.
Come and join us. So if you want, just go to outwear.com.au. And have a look around. If you like us, then throw us a resume.
Definitely do that. We do lots of cool stuff, hackathons, Apple Watch, Google Glass, all sorts of crazy and cool stuff, as well as obviously building nice iOS and Android apps. But,
but we have a lot of work.
We do.
So we're trying to expand out. And I'd like to shout out to some of the previous hosts on the podcast, Mr. Kent and Mr. Peter. This is other Peter.
Hi, guys.
Hello. They're in Europe right now. Europing.
In Europe.
Yeah. We're not going to do this over Skype. It's not going to work. Sweet. So if you want to follow Outwear, we're at Outwear on Twitter, on the Twitters, or you can go to our website, or I think we have Facebook now. I don't even know. We're on social media.
Yes, we have Facebook, Keith. Keith has just realized what Facebook is, and he's joined the...
It's the thing where people post pictures that were on Imgur 7 days ago. Yeah. And go, hey, guys, I found this really funny thing. It's great. Or clickbait articles. Like, these brother and sister stood up, and you'll never believe what they did next. I must click. But I don't. Cool. All right. So thanks you to everybody for coming in today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And big thank you to Mr. Alex Bird, who's making us sound good.
Thanks, Alex. Over there.
Thanks, Alex. He waddled in after falling off his bike. Thanks, Luce, for looking after us and nodding when I'm like, yep, I'm doing it right. Yep, good. Sweet. So, yeah, join us next time.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.